Book 5. Beginning of the End. Chapter 27. The New Order. No comprehensive blueprint for the New Order was ever drawn up, but it is clear from the captured documents and from what took place that Hitler knew very well what he wanted it to be. A Nazi-ruled Europe whose resources would be exploited for the profit of Germany, whose people would be made the slaves of the German master race, and whose undesirable elements, above all the Jews, but also many Slavs in the East, especially the intelligentsia among them, would be exterminated. The Jews and the Slavic peoples were the Untermenschen, subhumans. To Hitler they had no right to live, except as some of them, among the Slavs, might be needed to toil in the fields and the mines as slaves of their German masters. Not only were the great cities of the East, Moscow, Leningrad, and Warsaw, to be permanently erased, but the culture of the Russians and Poles and other Slavs was to be stamped out and formal education denied them. As early as September 18, 1941, Hitler had specifically ordered that Leningrad was to be wiped off the face of the earth. After being surrounded, it was to be razed to the ground by bombardment and bombing, and its population, 3 million, was to be destroyed with it. Their thriving industries were to be dismantled and shipped to Germany, and the people themselves confined to the pursuits of agriculture so that they could grow food for Germans, being allowed to keep for themselves just enough to subsist on. Europe itself, as the Nazi leaders put it, must be made Jew-free. "What happens to a Russian, to a Czech, does not interest me in the slightest," declared Heinrich Himmler on October 4, 1943, in a confidential address to his SS officers at Posen. By this time Himmler, as chief of the SS and the entire police apparatus of the Third Reich, was next to Hitler in importance, holding the power of life and death not only over 80 million Germans, but over twice that many conquered people. "What the nations," Himmler continued, "can offer in the way of good blood of our type, we will take, if necessary, by kidnapping their children and raising them here with us. Whether nations live in prosperity or starve to death like cattle interests me only insofar as we need them as slaves to our Kultur. Otherwise, it is of no interest to me. Whether 10,000 Russian females fall down from exhaustion while digging an anti-tank ditch interests me only insofar as the anti-tank ditch for Germany is finished." Long before Himmler's Posen speech in 1943, to which we shall return for it covers other aspects of the new order, the Nazi chiefs had laid down their thoughts and plans for enslaving the people of the East. By October 15, 1940, Hitler had decided on the future of the Czechs, the first Slavic people he had conquered. One half of them were to be assimilated, mostly by shipping them as slave labor to Germany. The other half, particularly the intellectuals, were simply to be, in the words of a secret report on the subject, eliminated. A fortnight before, on October 2nd, the Führer had clarified his thoughts about the fate of the Poles, the second of the Slavic peoples to be conquered. His faithful secretary, Martin Bormann, has left a long memorandum on the Nazi plans, which Hitler outlined to Hans Frank, the Governor-General of Rump Poland, and to other officials. "The Poles," Hitler emphasized, "are especially born for low labor. There can be no question of improvement for them. It is necessary to keep the standard of life low in Poland, and it must not be permitted to rise. The Poles are lazy, and it is necessary to use compulsion to make them work. The government general of Poland should be used by us merely as a source of unskilled labor. Every year the laborers needed by the Reich could be procured from there. As for the Polish priests, they will preach what we want them to preach. If any priest acts differently, we shall make short work of him. The task of the priest is to keep the Poles quiet, stupid, and dull-witted." There were two other classes of Poles to be dealt with, and the Nazi dictator did not neglect mention of them. "It is indispensable to bear in mind that the Polish gentry must cease to exist. However cruel this may sound, they must be exterminated wherever they are. There should be one master only for the Poles, the German. Two masters, side by side, cannot and must not exist. Therefore, all representatives of the Polish intelligentsia are to be exterminated. This sounds cruel, but such is the law of life." This obsession of the Germans with the idea that they were the master race and that the Slavic peoples must be their slaves was especially virulent in regard to Russia. Erich Kolk, the roughneck Reich Commissar for the Ukraine, expressed it in a speech at Kiev on March 5, 1943. "We are the master race and must govern hard but just. I will draw the very last out of this country. I did not come to spread bliss. The population must work, work, and work again. We definitely did not come here to give out manna. We have come here to create the basis for victory. We are a master race which must remember that the lowliest German worker is racially and biologically 1,000 times more valuable than the population here." Nearly a year before, on July 23, 1942, when the German armies in Russia were nearing the Volga and the oil fields of the Caucasus, Martin Bormann, Hitler's party secretary and by now right-hand man, wrote a long letter to Rosenberg reiterating the Führer's views on the subject. The letter was summed up by an official in Rosenberg's ministry. "The Slavs are to work for us. Insofar as we don't need them, they may die. Therefore, compulsory vaccination and German health services are superfluous. The fertility of the Slavs is undesirable. They may use contraceptives or practice abortion. The more the better. Education is dangerous. It is enough if they can count up to 100. Every educated person is a future enemy. Religion we leave to them as a means of diversion. As for food, they won't get any more than is absolutely necessary. We are the masters. We come first." When the German troops first entered Russia, they were in many places hailed as liberators by a population long ground down and terrorized by Stalin's tyranny. There were, in the beginning, wholesale desertions among the Russian soldiers. Especially in the Baltic, which had been under Soviet occupation but a short time, and in the Ukraine, where an incipient independence movement had never been quite stamped out, many were happy to be freed from the Soviet yoke, even by the Germans. There were a few in Berlin who believed that if Hitler played his cards shrewdly, treating the population with consideration and promising relief from Bolshevik practices, by granting religious and economic freedom and making true cooperatives out of the collectivized farms, and eventual self-government, the Russian people could be won over. They might then not only cooperate with the Germans in the occupied regions, but in the unoccupied ones strive for liberation from Stalin's harsh rule. If this were done, it was argued, the Bolshevik regime itself might collapse and the Red Army disintegrate, as the Tsarist armies had done in 1917. But the savagery of the Nazi occupation and the obvious aims of the German conquerors, often publicly proclaimed, to plunder the Russian lands, enslave their peoples, and colonize the East with Germans, soon destroyed any possibility of such a development. No one summed up this disastrous policy and all the opportunities it destroyed better than a German himself. Dr. Otto Breutigam, a career diplomat and the deputy leader of the political department of Rosenberg's newly created Ministry for the Occupied Eastern Territories. In a bitter confidential report to his superiors on October 25, 1942, Breutigam dared to pinpoint the Nazi mistakes in Russia. "In the Soviet Union, we found on our arrival a population weary of Bolshevism, which waited longingly for new slogans holding out the prospect of a better future for them. It was Germany's duty to find such slogans, but they remained unuttered. The population greeted us with joy as liberators and placed themselves at our disposal." Actually, there was a slogan, but the Russian people soon saw through it. "With the inherent instinct of the Eastern peoples," Breutigam continued, "the primitive man soon found out that for Germany the slogan liberation from Bolshevism was only a pretext to enslave the Eastern peoples according to her own methods. The worker and peasant soon perceived that Germany did not regard them as partners of equal rights, but considered them only as the objective of her political and economic aims. With unequaled presumption, we put aside all political knowledge and treat the peoples of the occupied Eastern territories as second-class whites, to whom Providence has merely assigned the task of serving as slaves for Germany." There were two other developments, Breutigam declared, which had turned the Russians against the Germans: the barbaric treatment of Soviet prisoners of war and the Shanghaiing of Russian men and women for slave labor. "It is no longer a secret from friend or foe that hundreds of thousands of Russian prisoners of war have died of hunger or cold in our camps. We now experience the grotesque picture of having to recruit millions of laborers from the occupied eastern territories after prisoners of war have died of hunger like flies. In the prevailing limitless abuse of the Slavic humanity, recruiting methods were used which probably have their origin only in the blackest periods of the slave traffic. A regular manhunt was inaugurated. Without consideration of health or age, the people were shipped to Germany. Neither the extermination of masses of Soviet prisoners of war nor the exploitation of Russian slave labor was a secret to the Kremlin. As early as November 1941, Molotov had made a formal diplomatic protest against the extermination of Russian POWs, and in April of the following year he made another protest against the German slave labor program. German policy and practice in Russia had brought about the enormous resistance of the Eastern peoples, this official concluded. Our policy has forced both Bolshevists and Russian nationalists into a common front against us. The Russian fights today with exceptional bravery and self-sacrifice for nothing more or less than recognition of his human dignity. Closing his 13-page memorandum on a positive note, Dr. Breutigam asked for a complete change of policy. The Russian people, he argued, must be told something concrete about their future. But this was a voice in the Nazi wilderness. Hitler, as we have seen, already had laid down, before the attack began, his directives on what would be done with Russia and the Russians, and he was not a man who could be persuaded by any living German to change them by one iota. On July 16, 1941, less than a month after the commencement of the Russian campaign, but when it was already evident from the initial German successes that a large slice of the Soviet Union would soon be within grasp, Hitler convoked Göring, Keitel, Rosenberg, Bormann, and Lammers, the last head of the Reich Chancellery, to his headquarters in East Prussia to remind them of his aims in the newly conquered land. At last, his goal, so clearly stated in Mein Kampf, of securing a vast German Lebensraum in Russia, was in sight, and it is clear from the confidential memorandum of the meeting drawn up by Bormann, which showed up at Nuremberg, that he wanted his chief lieutenants to understand well what he intended to do with it. His intentions, he admonished, must, however, not be publicized. There is no need for that, Hitler said, but the main thing is that we ourselves know what we want. Nobody must be able to recognize that it initiates a final settlement. This need not prevent our taking all necessary measures, shooting, resettling, etc., and we shall take them. In principle, Hitler continued, we now have to face the task of cutting up the cake according to our needs in order to be able, first, to dominate it, second, to administer it, third, to exploit it. He did not mind, he said, that the Russians had ordered partisan warfare behind the German lines. It enables us to eradicate everyone who opposes us. In general, Hitler explained, Germany would dominate the Russian territory up to the Urals. None but Germans would be permitted to carry weapons in that vast space. Then Hitler went over specifically what would be done with various slices of the Russian cake. The entire Baltic country will have to be incorporated into Germany. The Crimea has to be evacuated by all foreigners and settled by Germans only, becoming Reich territory. The Kola Peninsula will be taken by Germany because of the large nickel mines there. The annexation of Finland as a federated state should be prepared with caution. The Führer will raze Leningrad to the ground and then hand it over to the Finns. The Baku oil fields, Hitler ordered, would become a German concession. And the German colonies on the Volga would be annexed outright. When it came to a discussion as to which Nazi leaders would administer the new territory, a violent quarrel broke out. Rosenberg states he intends to use Captain von Petersdorf, owing to his special merits, general consternation, general rejections. The Führer and the Reich Marshal, Göring, both emphasized that there was no doubt that von Petersdorf was insane. There was also an argument on the best methods of policing the conquered Russian people. Hitler suggested the German police be equipped with armored cars. Göring doubted that they would be necessary. His planes could drop bombs in case of riots, he said. Naturally, Göring added, this giant area would have to be pacified as quickly as possible. The best solution would be to shoot anybody who looked sideways. A year before, it will be remembered, Göring had told Chano that this year between 20 and 30 million persons will die of hunger in Russia, and that perhaps it is well that it should be so. Already, he said, Russian prisoners of war had begun to eat each other. Goering, as head of the four-year plan, was also put in charge of the economic exploitation of Russia. In a directive of Goering's economic staff, East, on May 23, 1941, the destruction of the Russian industrial areas was ordered. The workers and their families in these regions were to be left to starve. Any attempt to save the population there, the directive stated, from death by starvation by importing food surpluses from the black soil zone of Russia was prohibited. Plunder would be a better word, as Goering made clear in a speech to the Nazi commissioners for the occupied territories on August 6, 1942. It used to be called plundering, he said, but today things have become more humane. In spite of that, I intend to plunder and to do it thoroughly. On this, at least, he was as good as his word, not only in Russia but throughout Nazi-conquered Europe. It was all part of the new order. The Nazi plunder of Europe. The total amount of loot will never be known. It is proved beyond man's capacity to accurately compute. But some figures are available, many of them from the Germans themselves. They show with what Germanic thoroughness the instructions which Goering once gave to his subordinates were carried out. Whenever you come across anything that may be needed by the German people, you must be after it like a bloodhound. It must be taken out and brought to Germany. A great deal was taken out, not only in goods and services, but in banknotes and gold. Whenever Hitler occupied a country, his financial agents seized the gold and foreign holdings of its national bank. That was a mere beginning. Staggering occupation costs were immediately assessed. By the end of February 1944, Count Schwerin von Krussig, the Nazi Minister of Finance, put the total take from such payments at some 48 billion marks, roughly $12 billion, of which France, which was milked heavier than any other conquered country, furnished more than half. By the end of the war, receipts from occupation assessments amounted to an estimated 60 billion marks, $15 billion. France was forced to pay 31.5 billions of this total, its annual contributions of more than 7 billions coming to over four times the yearly sums which Germany had paid in reparations under the Dawes and Young plans after the First War, a tribute which had seemed such a heinous crime to Hitler. In addition, the Bank of France was forced to grant credits to Germany totaling 4.5 billion marks, and the French government to pay a further half a billion in fines. At Nuremberg, it was estimated that the Germans extracted in occupation costs and credits 2/3 of Belgium's national income and a similar percentage from the Netherlands. Altogether, according to a study by the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, Germany extracted in tribute from the conquered nations a total of 104 billion marks, $26 billion. At the official rate of exchange, 2.5 Reichsmarks to the dollar, this would amount to $40 billion, but I have used the unofficial rate of 4 Reichsmarks to the dollar. In terms of purchasing power, it is more accurate. But the goods seized and transported to the Reich without even the formality of payment can never possibly be estimated. Figures kept pouring in at Nuremberg until they overwhelmed one, but no expert, so far as I know, was ever able to straighten them out and compute totals. In France, for example, it was estimated that the Germans carted off, as levies in kind, 9 million tons of cereals, 75% of the total production of oats, 80% of oil, 74% of steel, and so on, for a grand total of 184.5 billion francs. Russia, devastated by warfare and German savagery, proved harder to milk. Nazi documents are full of reports of Soviet deliveries. In 1943, for example, 9 million tons of cereals, 2 million tons of fodder, 3 million tons of potatoes, 662,000 tons of meat were listed by the Germans among the deliveries to which the Soviet Committee of Investigation added, for the duration of the occupation, 9 million cattle, 12 million pigs, 13 million sheep, to mention a few items. But Russian deliveries proved much less than expected. The Germans calculated them as worth a net of only some 4 billion marks, $1 billion. According to Alexander Dahlen in his exhaustive study of German rule in Russia, Germany could have obtained more from Russia in normal trade. See Dahlen, German Rule in Russia. Everything possible was squeezed out of Poland by the greedy Nazi conquerors. I shall endeavor, said Dr. Franck, the governor-general, to squeeze out of this province everything that is still possible to squeeze out. This was at the end of 1942, and in the 3 years since the occupation he had already squeezed out, as he continually boasted, a great deal, especially in foodstuffs for hungry Germans in the Reich. He warned, however, that if the new food scheme is carried out in 1943, 500,000 people in Warsaw and its suburbs alone will be deprived of food. The nature of the new order in Poland had been laid down as soon as the country was conquered. On October 3, 1939, Franck informed the army of Hitler's orders. Poland can only be administered by utilizing the country through means of ruthless exploitation, deportation of all supplies, raw materials, machines, factory installations, etc., which are important for the German war economy, availability of all workers for work within Germany, reduction of the entire Polish economy to absolute minimum necessary for bare existence of the population, closing of all educational institutions, especially technical schools and colleges, in order to prevent the growth of the new Polish intelligentsia. Poland shall be treated as a colony. The Poles shall be the slaves of the Greater German Reich. Rudolf Hess, the Nazi deputy Führer, added that Hitler had decided that Warsaw shall not be rebuilt, nor is it the intention of the Führer to rebuild or reconstruct any industry in the government general. By decree of Dr. Franck, all property in Poland belonging not only to Jews but to Poles was subject to confiscation without compensation. Hundreds of thousands of Polish-owned farms were simply grabbed and handed over to German settlers. By May 31, 1943, in the four Polish districts annexed to Germany, West Prussia, Posen, Zichenau, Silesia, some 700,000 estates comprising 15 million acres were seized, and 9,500 estates totaling 6.5 million acres confiscated. The difference between seizure and confiscation is not explained in the elaborate table prepared by the German Central Estate Office, and to the dispossessed Poles it must not have mattered. Even the art treasures in the occupied lands were looted, and, as the captured Nazi documents later revealed, on the express orders of Hitler and Göring, who thereby greatly augmented their private collections. The corpulent Reich Marshal, according to his own estimate, brought his own collection up to a value of 50 million Reichsmarks. Indeed, Göring was the driving force in this particular field of looting. Immediately upon the conquest of Poland, he issued orders for the seizure of art treasures there, and within 6 months the special commissioner appointed to carry out his command could report that he had taken over almost the entire art treasury of the country. But it was in France where the bulk of the great art treasures of Europe lay, and no sooner was this country added to the Nazi conquests than Hitler and Göring decreed their seizure. To carry out this particular plunder, Hitler appointed Rosenberg, who set up an organization called Einsatzstab Rosenberg, and who was assisted not only by Göring but by General Keitel. Indeed, one order by Keitel to the army in France stated that Rosenberg is entitled to transport to Germany cultural goods which appear valuable to him and to safeguard them there. The Führer has reserved for himself the decision as to their use. An idea of Hitler's decision as to their use is revealed in a secret order issued by Göring on November 5, 1940, specifying the distribution of art objects being collected at the Louvre in Paris. They were to be disposed of in the following way. 1. Those art objects about which the Führer has reserved for himself the decision as to their use. 2. Those which serve the completion of the Reich Marshal's, i.e. Göring's, collection. 4. Those that are suited to be sent to German museums. The French government protested the looting of the country's art treasures, declaring that it was a violation of the Hague Convention, and when one German art expert on Rosenberg's staff, a Herr Bunyas, dared to call this to the attention of Göring, the fat one replied, "My dear Bunyas, let me worry about that. I am the highest jurist in the state. It is my orders which are decisive, and you will act accordingly." And so, according to a report of Bunyas, it is his only appearance in the history of the Third Reich, so far as the documents show, those art objects collected at the Jeu de Paume, which are to go into the Führer's possession, and those which the Reich Marshal claims for himself, will be loaded into two railroad cars which will be attached to the Reich Marshal's special train to Berlin. Many more carloads followed. According to a secret official German report, some 137 freight cars loaded with 4,174 cases of artworks comprising 21,903 objects, including 10,890 paintings, made the journey from the West to Germany up to July 1944. They included works of, among others, Rembrandt, Rubens, Hals, Vermeer, Velázquez, Murillo, Goya, Vecchio, Watteau, Fragonard, Reynolds, and Gainsborough. As early as January 1941, Rosenberg estimated the art loot from France alone as worth a billion marks. The plunder of raw materials, manufactured goods, and food, though it reduced the occupied peoples to impoverishment, hunger, and sometimes starvation, and violated the Hague Convention on the Conduct of War, might have been excused, if not justified, by the Germans as necessitated by the harsh exigencies of total war. But the stealing of art treasures did not help Hitler's war machine. It was a case merely of avarice, of the personal greed of Hitler and Goering. All this plunder and spoliation the conquered populations could have endured, wars and enemy occupation had always brought privation in their wake. But this was only a part of the new order, the mildest part. It was in the plunder not of material goods, but of human lives, that the mercifully short-lived new order will be longest remembered. Here Nazi degradation sank to a level seldom experienced by man in all his time on earth. Millions of decent, innocent men and women were driven into forced labor, millions more tortured and tormented in the concentration camps, and millions more still, of whom there were 4.5 million Jews alone, were massacred in cold blood or deliberately starved to death, and their remains, in order to remove the traces, burned. This incredible story of horror would be unbelievable were it not fully documented and testified to by the perpetrators themselves. What follows here, a mere summary which must, because of limitations of space, leave out 1,000 shocking details, is based on that incontrovertible evidence, with occasional corroboration from the eyewitness accounts of the few survivors. Slave labor in the new order. By the end of September 1944, some 7.5 million civilian foreigners were toiling for the Third Reich. Nearly all of them had been rounded up by force, deported to Germany in boxcars, usually without food or water or any sanitary facilities, and there put to work in the factories, fields, and mines. They were not only put to work, but degraded, beaten, and starved, and often left to die for lack of food, clothing, and shelter. In addition, 2 million prisoners of war were added to the foreign labor force, at least 500,000 of whom were made to work in the armaments and munitions industries in flagrant violation of the Hague and Geneva Conventions, which stipulated that no war prisoners could be employed in such tasks. Albert Speer, Minister for Armament and War Production, admitted at Nuremberg that 40% of all prisoners of war were employed in 1944 in the production of weapons and munitions, and in subsidiary industries. This figure did not include the hundreds of thousands of other POWs who were impressed into the building of fortifications and in carrying ammunition to the front lines and even in manning anti-aircraft guns, in further disregard of the international conventions which Germany had signed. A captured record shows Field Marshal Milch of the Air Force in 1943 demanding 50,000 more Russian war prisoners to be added to the 30,000 already manning anti-aircraft artillery. "It is amusing," Milch laughed, "that Russians must work the guns." In the massive deportations of slave labor to the Reich, wives were torn away from their husbands and children from their parents and assigned to widely separated parts of Germany. The young, if they were old enough to work at all, were not spared. Even top generals of the army cooperated in the kidnapping of children, who were carted off to the homeland to perform slave labor. A memorandum from Rosenberg's files of June 12, 1944, reveals this practice in occupied Russia. "Army Group Center intends to apprehend 40 to 50,000 youths from the age of 10 to 14 and transport them to the Reich. The measure was originally proposed by the Ninth Army. It is intended to allot these juveniles primarily to the German trades as apprentices. This action is being greatly welcomed by the German trade since it represents a decisive measure for the alleviation of the shortage of apprentices. This action is not only aimed at preventing a direct reinforcement of the enemy's strength, but also as a reduction of his biological potentialities. The kidnapping operation had a code name, Hay Action. It was also being carried out, the memorandum added, by Field Marshal Model's Army Group Ukraine North. Increasing terrorization was used to round up the victims. At first, comparatively mild methods were used. Persons coming out of church or the movies were nabbed. In the West, especially, SS units merely blocked off a section of a town and seized all able-bodied men and women. Villages were surrounded and searched for the same purposes. In the East, when there was resistance to the forced labor order, villages were simply burned down and their inhabitants carted off. Rosenberg's captured files are replete with German reports of such happenings. In Poland, at least one German official thought things were going a little too far. "The wild and ruthless manhunt," he wrote to Governor Frank, "as exercised everywhere in towns and countries, in streets, squares, stations, even in churches, at night in homes, has badly shaken the feeling of security of the inhabitants. Everybody is exposed to the danger of being seized anywhere and at any time by the police, suddenly and unexpectedly, and of being sent to an assembly camp. None of his relatives knows what has happened to him." But rounding up the slave workers was only the first step. The entire slave labor program was put in charge of Fritz Sauckel, who was given the title of plenipotentiary general for the allocation of labor. A second-string Nazi, he had been Gauleiter and governor of Thuringia. A pig-eyed little man, rude and tough, he was, as Goebbels mentioned in his diary, one of the dullest of the dull. In the dock at Nuremberg, he struck this writer as being a complete nonentity, the sort of German who in other times might have been a butcher in a small-town meat market. One of his first directives laid it down that the foreign workers were to be treated in such a way as to exploit them to the highest possible extent at the lowest conceivable degree of expenditure. He admitted at Nuremberg that of all the millions of foreign workers, not even 200,000 came voluntarily. However, at the trial, he denied all responsibility for their ill treatment. He was found guilty, sentenced to death, and hanged in the Nuremberg jail on the night of October 15th to 16th, 1946. The condition of their transport to Germany left something to be desired. A certain Dr. Gutkelk described one instance in a report to Rosenberg's ministry on September 30th, 1942. Recounting how a train packed with returning, worked-out Eastern laborers met a train at a siding near Brest-Litovsk full of newly recruited Russian workers bound for Germany, he wrote, "Because of the corpses in the trainload of returning laborers, a catastrophe might have occurred. In this train, women gave birth to babies who were thrown out of the windows during the journey. Persons having tuberculosis and venereal diseases rode in the same car. Dying people lay in freight cars without straw, and one of the dead was thrown on the railway embankment. The same must have occurred in other returning transports." This was not a very promising introduction to the Third Reich for the Ostarbeiter, but at least it prepared them somewhat for the ordeal that lay ahead. Hunger lay ahead, and beatings, and disease, and exposure to the cold, in unheated quarters and in their thin rags. Long hours of labor lay ahead that were limited only by their ability to stand on their feet. The great Krupp Works, makers of Germany's guns and tanks and ammunition, was a typical place of employment. Krupp employed a large number of slave laborers, including Russian prisoners of war. At one point during the war, 600 Jewish women from the Buchenwald concentration camp were brought in to work at Krupp's, being housed in a bombed-out work camp from which the previous inmates, Italian POWs, had been removed. Dr. Wilhelm Jaeger, the senior doctor for Krupp's slaves, described in an affidavit at Nuremberg what he found there when he took over. "Upon my first visit, I found these females suffering from open festering wounds and other diseases. I was the first doctor they had seen for at least a fortnight. There were no medical supplies. They had no shoes and went about in their bare feet. The sole clothing of each consisted of a sack with holes for their arms and head. Their hair was shorn. The camp was surrounded by barbed wire and closely guarded by SS guards. The amount of food in the camp was extremely meager and of very poor quality. One could not enter the barracks without being attacked by fleas. I got large boils on my arms and the rest of my body from them." Dr. Jaeger reported the situation to the directors of Krupp, and even to the personal physician of Gustav Krupp von Bohlen und Halbach, the owner, but in vain. Nor did his reports on other Krupp slave labor camps bring any alleviation. He recalled in his affidavit some of these reports of conditions in 8 camps inhabited by Russian and Polish workers. Overcrowding that bred disease, lack of enough food to keep a man alive, lack of water, lack of toilets. The clothing of the Eastern workers was likewise completely inadequate. They worked and slept in the same clothing in which they had arrived from the East. Virtually all of them had no overcoats and were compelled to use their blankets as coats in cold and rainy weather. In view of the shortage of shoes, many workers were forced to go to work in their bare feet, even in winter. Sanitary conditions were atrocious. At Kramerplatz, only 10 children's toilets were available for 1,200 inhabitants. Excretion contaminated the entire floors of these lavatories. The Tartars and Kyrgyz suffered most. They collapsed like flies from bad housing, the poor quality and insufficient quantity of food, overwork and insufficient rest. These workers were likewise afflicted with spotted fever. Lice, the carrier of the disease, together with countless fleas, bugs, and other vermin, tortured the inhabitants of these camps. At times, the water supply at the camps was shut off for periods of from 8 to 14 days. On the whole, Western slave workers fared better than those from the East, the latter being considered by the Germans as mere scum. But the difference was only relative, as Dr. Jaeger found at one of Krupp's work camps occupied by French prisoners of war in Nogaretstrasse at Essen. Its inhabitants were kept for nearly half a year in dog kennels, urinals, and in old baking houses. The dog kennels were 3 feet high, 9 feet long, 6 feet wide. 5 men slept in each of them. The prisoners had to crawl into these kennels on all fours. There was no water in the camp. Besides obtaining thousands of slave laborers, both civilians and prisoners of war, for its factories in Germany, the Krupp firm also built a large fuse factory at the extermination camp at Auschwitz, where Jews were worked to exhaustion and then gassed to death. Baron Gustav Krupp von Bohlen und Halbach, the chairman of the board, was indicted as a major war criminal at Nuremberg, along with Göring et al. But because of his physical and mental condition, he had had a stroke and had faded into senility, he was not tried. He died on January 16, 1950. An effort was made by the prosecution to try in his stead his son, Alfred, who had acquired sole ownership of the company in 1943, but the tribunal denied this. Alfred Krupp von Bohlen und Halbach was subsequently tried before a Nuremberg military tribunal, a purely American court, along with 9 directors of the firm, in the United States versus Alfred Krupp et al. Case. On July 31, 1948, he was sentenced to 12 years imprisonment and confiscation of all his property. He was released from Landsberg prison, where Hitler had served his sentence in 1924, on February 4, 1951, in a general amnesty issued by John J. McCloy, the U.S. High Commissioner. Not only was the confiscation of his corporate property annulled, but his personal fortune of some $10 million was returned to him. The Allied governments had ordered the breakup of the vast Krupp Empire, but Alfred Krupp, who took over the active management of the firm after his release from prison, evaded the order, and at the time of writing, 1959, announced, with the approval of the Bonn government, that not only would the company not be broken up, but that it was acquiring new industries. Some 2.5 million slave laborers, mostly Slavs and Italians, were assigned to farm work in Germany. And though their life from the very force of circumstances was better than that of those in the city factories, it was far from ideal, or even humane. A captured directive on the treatment of foreign farm workers of Polish nationality gives an inkling of their treatment. And though applied to Poles, it is dated March 6, 1941, before Russians became available, it was later used as guidance for those of other nationalities. Farm workers of Polish nationality no longer have the right to complain, and thus no complaints will be accepted by any official agency. The visit of churches is strictly prohibited. Visits to theaters, motion pictures, or other cultural entertainment are strictly prohibited. Sexual intercourse with women and girls is strictly prohibited. If it was with German females, it was, according to an edict of Himmler in 1942, punishable by death. Himmler's directive of February 20, 1942, was directed especially against Russian slave workers. It ordered special treatment also for severe violations against discipline, including work refusal or loafing at work. In such cases, special treatment is requested. Special treatment is hanging. It should not take place in the immediate vicinity of the camp. A certain number, however, should attend the special treatment. The term special treatment was a common one in Himmler's files and in Nazi parlance during the war. It meant just what Himmler, in this directive, said it meant. The use of railroads, buses, or other public conveyances was prohibited for slave farm workers. This apparently was ordained so that they would not escape from the farms to which they were bound. Arbitrary change of employment, the directive stated, is strictly prohibited. The farm workers have to labor as long as is demanded by the employer. There are no time limits to the working time. Every employer has the right to give corporal punishment to his farm workers. They should, if possible, be removed from the community of the home, and they can be quartered in stables, etc. No remorse whatever should restrict such action. Even the Slav women seized and shipped to Germany for domestic service were treated as slaves. As early as 1942, Hitler had commanded Zalkel to procure 500,000 of them in order to relieve the German housewife. The slave labor commissar laid down the conditions of work in the German households. There is no claim to free time. Female domestic workers from the East may leave the household only to take care of domestic tasks. It is prohibited for them to enter restaurants, movies, theaters, and similar establishments. Attending church is also prohibited. Women, it is obvious, were almost as necessary as men in the Nazi slave labor program. Of some 3 million Russian civilians pressed into service by the Germans, more than one half were women. Most of them were assigned to do heavy farm work and to labor in the factories. The enslavement of millions of men and women of the conquered lands as lowly toilers for the Third Reich was not just a wartime measure. From the statements of Hitler, Goering, Himmler, and the others already cited, and they are only a tiny sampling, it is clear that if Nazi Germany had endured, the new order would have meant the rule of the German master race over a vast slave empire, stretching from the Atlantic to the Ural Mountains. To be sure, the Slavs in the East would have fared the worst. As Hitler emphasized in July 1941, scarcely a month after he had attacked the Soviet Union, his plans for its occupation constituted a final settlement. A year later, at the high tide of his Russian conquests, he admonished his aides, "As for the ridiculous 100 million Slavs, we will mold the best of them to the shape that suits us, and we will isolate the rest of them in their own pigsties, and anyone who talks about cherishing the local inhabitant and civilizing him goes straight off to a concentration camp." The Prisoners of War. Though it was a flagrant violation of the Hague and Geneva Conventions to use prisoners of war in armament factories or in any labor connected with the fighting at the front, such employment, massive as it was, constituted the least of worries for the millions of soldiers captured by the Third Reich. Their overwhelming concern was to survive the war. If they were Russian, the odds were greatly against them. There were more Soviet war prisoners than all others put together. Some 5.75 million of them. Of these, barely 1 million were found alive when Allied troops liberated the inmates of the POW camps in 1945. About 1 million had either been released during the war or allowed to serve in the collaborator units set up by the German army. 2 million Russian prisoners of war died in German captivity, from starvation, exposure, and disease. The remaining 1 million have never been accounted for, and at Nuremberg a good case was made that most of them either had died from the above causes or had been exterminated by the SD, SS Security Service. According to the German records, 67,000 were executed, but this is most certainly a partial figure. The bulk of the Russian war prisoners, some 3,800,000 of them, were taken by the Germans in the first phase of the Russian campaign, in the great battles of encirclement which were fought from June 21st to December 6th, 1941. Admittedly, it was difficult for an army in the midst of combat and rapid advance to care adequately for such a large number of captives. But the Germans made no effort to. Indeed, the Nazi records show, as we have seen, that the Soviet prisoners were deliberately starved and left out in the open without shelter to die in the terrible sub-zero snowbound winter of 1941-42. The more of these prisoners who die, the better it is for us, was the attitude of many Nazi officials, according to no less an authority than Rosenberg. The clumsy minister for the occupied Eastern Territories was not a humane Nazi, particularly in regard to the Russians, with whom, as we have seen, he had grown up. But even he was moved to protest the treatment of Russian prisoners in a long letter to General Keitel, the chief of OKW, dated February 28, 1942. This was the moment when the Soviet counteroffensive, which had hurled the Germans back before Moscow and Rostov, had reached its farthest penetrations that winter, and when the Germans had realized at last that their gamble of destroying Russia in one short campaign, or perhaps ever, had failed, and that just possibly, now that the USA had been added to Russia and Britain as their enemies, they might not win the war, in which case they would be held accountable for their war crimes. The fate of the Soviet prisoners of war in Germany, Rosenberg wrote Keitel, is a tragedy of the greatest extent. Of the 3,600,000 of them, only several hundred thousand are still able to work fully. A large part of them have starved or died because of the hazards of the weather. This could have been avoided, Rosenberg continued. There was food enough in Russia to provide them. However, in the majority of cases, the camp commanders have forbidden food to be put at the disposal of the prisoners. They have rather let them starve to death. Even on the march to the camps, the civilian population was not allowed to give the prisoners food. In many cases, when the prisoners could no longer keep up on the march because of hunger and exhaustion, they were shot before the eyes of the horrified civilian population, and the corpses were left. In numerous camps, no shelter for the prisoners was provided at all. They lay under the open sky during rain or snow. Finally, the shooting of prisoners of war must be mentioned. These ignore all political understanding. For instance, in various camps, all the Asiatics were shot. Not only Asiatics. Shortly after the beginning of the Russian campaign, an agreement was reached between OKW and the SS Security Service for the latter to screen Russian prisoners. The objective was disclosed in an affidavit by Otto Ohlendorf, one of the SD's great killers, and like so many of the men around Himmler, a displaced intellectual, for he had university degrees both in the law and in economics, and had been a professor at the Institute for Applied Economic Science. All Jews and communist functionaries, Ohlendorf testified, were to be removed from the prisoner of war camps and were to be executed. To my knowledge, this action was carried out throughout the entire Russian campaign. But not without difficulties. Sometimes the Russian captives were so exhausted that they could not even walk to their execution. This brought a protest from Heinrich Müller, the chief of the Gestapo, a dapper-looking fellow but also a cold, dispassionate killer. Müller was never apprehended after the war. He was last seen in Hitler's bunker in Berlin on April 29, 1945. Some of his surviving colleagues believe he is now in the service of the Soviet secret police, of which he was a great admirer. The commanders of the concentration camps are complaining that 5 to 10% of the Soviet Russians destined for execution are arriving in the camps dead or half-dead. It was particularly noted that when marching, for example, from the railroad station to the camp, a rather large number of prisoners collapsed on the way from exhaustion, either dead or half-dead, and had to be picked up by a truck following the convoy. It cannot be prevented that the German people take notice of these occurrences. The Gestapo didn't care a rap about the Russian captives falling dead from starvation and exhaustion, except that it robbed the executioners of their prey. But they didn't want the German people to see the spectacle. Gestapo Müller, as he was known in Germany, therefore ordered that, effective from today, November 9, 1941, Soviet Russians obviously marked by death and who therefore are not able to withstand the exertions of even a short march shall in the future be excluded from the transport into the concentration camps for execution. Dead prisoners or even starved and exhausted ones could not perform work, and in 1942, when it became obvious to the Germans that the war was going to last considerably longer than they had expected and that the captive Soviet soldiers constituted a badly needed labor reservoir, the Nazis abandoned their policy of exterminating them in favor of working them. Himmler explained the change in his speech to the SS at Posen in 1943. At that time, 1941, we did not value the mass of humanity as we value it today, as raw material, as labor. What, after all, thinking in terms of generations, is not to be regretted but is now deplorable by reason of the loss of labor, is that the prisoners died in tens and hundreds of thousands of exhaustion and hunger. They were now to be fed enough to enable them to work. By December 1944, 750,000 of them, including many officers, were toiling in the armament factories, the mines, where 200,000 were assigned, and on the farms. Their treatment was harsh, but at least they were allowed to live. Even the branding of the Russian war captives, which General Keitel had proposed, was abandoned. On July 20, 1942, Keitel had drafted the order. 1. Soviet prisoners of war are to be branded with a special and durable mark. 2. The brand is to consist of an acute angle of about 45 degrees with a 1 centimeter length of side, pointing downward on the left buttock at about a hand's width from the rectum. The treatment of Western prisoners of war, especially of the British and Americans, was comparatively milder than that meted out by the Germans to the Russians. There were occasional instances of the murder and massacre of them, but this was due usually to the excessive sadism and cruelty of individual commanders. Such a case was the slaughter in cold blood of 71 American prisoners of war in a field near Malmedy, Belgium, on December 17, 1944, during the Battle of the Bulge. There were other occasions when Hitler himself ordered the murder of Western prisoners, as he did in the case of 50 British flyers who were caught in the spring of 1944 after escaping from a camp at Zagen. At Nuremberg, Goering said he considered it the most serious incident of the whole war, and General Jodl called it sheer murder. Actually, it seemed to be part of a deliberate German policy, adopted after Anglo-American bombing of Germany became so extensive from 1943 on, to encourage the killing of Allied airmen who had bailed out over Germany. Civilians were encouraged to lynch the flyers as soon as they had parachuted to the ground, and a number of these Germans were tried after the war for having done so. In 1944, when the Anglo-American bombings were reaching their peak, Ribbentrop urged that airmen shot down be summarily executed, but Hitler took a somewhat milder view. On May 21, 1944, in agreement with Goering, he merely ordered that captured flyers who had machine-gunned passenger trains or civilians or German planes, which had made emergency landings, be shot without court-martial. Sometimes captured flyers were simply turned over to the SD for special treatment. Thus, some 47 American, British, and Dutch flyers, all officers, were brutally murdered at Mauthausen concentration camp in September 1944. An eyewitness, Maurice Lamp, a French inmate at the camp, described at Nuremberg how it was done. The 47 officers were led barefooted to the quarry. At the bottom of the steps, the guards loaded stones on the backs of these poor men, and they had to carry them to the top. The first journey was made with stones weighing about 60 pounds and accompanied by blows. The second journey, the stones were still heavier, and whenever the poor wretches sank under their burden, they were kicked and hit with a bludgeon. In the evening, 21 bodies were strewn along the road. The 26 others died the following morning. This was a familiar form of execution at Mauthausen, and was used on, among others, a good many Russian prisoners of war. From 1942 on, that is when the tide of war began to surge against him, Hitler ordered the extermination of captured Allied commandos, especially in the West. Captured Soviet partisans were summarily shot as a matter of course. The Führer's top-secret commando order of October 18, 1942 is among the Nazi documents. From now on, all enemies on so-called commando missions in Europe or Africa challenged by German troops, even if they are in uniform, whether armed or unarmed, in battle or in flight, are to be slaughtered to the last man. In a supplementary directive issued the same day, Hitler explained to his commanders the reason for his order. Because of the success of the Allied commandos, he said, "I have been compelled to issue strict orders for the destruction of enemy sabotage troops, and to declare non-compliance with these orders severely punishable. It must be made clear to the enemy that all sabotage troops will be exterminated, without exception, to the last man. This means that their chance of escaping with their lives is nil. Under no circumstances can they expect to be treated according to the rules of the Geneva Convention. If it should become necessary, for reasons of interrogation, to initially spare one man or two, then they are to be shot immediately after interrogation." This particular crime was to be kept strictly secret. General Jodl appended instructions to Hitler's directive, underlining his words. This order is intended for commanders only, and must not under any circumstances fall into enemy hands. They were directed to destroy all copies of it after they had duly taken note. It must have remained imprinted on their minds, for they proceeded to carry it out. A couple of instances of many may be given. On the night of March 22, 1944, two officers and 13 men of the 267th Special Reconnaissance Battalion of the U.S. Army landed from a naval craft far behind the German lines in Italy to demolish a railroad tunnel between La Spezia and Genoa. They were all in uniform and carried no civilian clothes. Captured 2 days later, they were executed by a firing squad on March 26th, without trial, on the direct orders of General Anton Dostler, commander of the 75th German Army Corps. Tried by a U.S. military tribunal shortly after the war, General Dostler justified his action by contending that he was merely obeying Hitler's commando order. He argued that he himself would have been court-martialed by the Führer if he had not obeyed. General Dostler was condemned to death by the U.S. military tribunal in Rome on October 12, 1945. Some 15 members of an Anglo-American military mission, including a war correspondent of the Associated Press and all in uniform, which had parachuted into Slovakia in January 1945, were executed at Mauthausen concentration camp on the orders of Dr. Ernst Kaltenbrunner, the successor of Heydrich as head of the SD and one of the defendants at Nuremberg. Kaltenbrunner was hanged at Nuremberg jail on the night of October 15th to 16th, 1946. Had it not been for the testimony of a camp adjutant who witnessed their execution, their murder might have remained unknown, for most of the files of the mass executions at this camp were destroyed.